Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have three cases for oral submission on our docket this morning, and you all are the first case. To my left, we have Justice Wade Birdwell. We're very happy to have him joining us. Today is his first time sitting with us, so
thank you.
Welcome. And we have Justice Bill Meyer, and it is not his first time sitting
Good
with
morning.
Us. And I am Sue Walker. We are your panel for today. And counsel, I understand you have announced the time you need to argue, and if y'all are ready to proceed, we will go forward. All right.
May it please the court. My name is Dania Blair. I'm here today on behalf of my client, Scott Miller, a local financial advisor and small business owner. We are seeking this court's de novo review of the trial court's vacature of an award of attorney's fees to Mr. Miller by a panel of three arbitrators. This dispute arose in May of 2015 when Mr. Miller's associate financial advisor, Jeremy Walker, left Mr. Miller's financial practice. He took confidential customer information with him and used it to aggressively solicit Mr. Miller's Ameriprise clients, in violation of his written promises not to do so. After multiple cease and desist letters were ineffective, Ameriprise and Mr. Miller sought an injunction in state court and brought a claim for breach of contract against Mr. Walker. That was brought in on June 5th, 2015. That claim was arbitrated through FINRA, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, formerly the NASD. It was arbitrated through FINRA not because of any written arbitration agreement, but because both Mr. Walker and Mr. Miller are registered with FINRA and are FINRA-associated persons. They are required and bound by FINRA rules to arbitrate their business disputes through FINRA under FINRA Rule 13200. All of the parties in the case recognize this by signing uniform submission agreements at the beginning of the arbitration, agreeing to submit the issues raised by their pleadings to the FINRA arbitration panel. It was never suggested by any party before or during the arbitration that the arbitration was conducted pursuant to a written arbitration clause. Then, at the conclusion of the arbitration, Mr. Walker's counsel, a FINRA arbitrator himself, gave the panel a sworn affidavit setting out the basis on which they were authorized to award attorney's fees. Those grounds did not include the arbitration clause in the 2009 AFA agreement. That was not mentioned. Rather, Walker's counsel referenced and told the panel, referenced the pleadings, FINRA rules, and Texas law. He told the panel, quite correctly, that Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code 38001 provides a statutory basis for attorney's fees. He also told the FINRA arbitration panel that in accordance with the FINRA Dispute Resolution Arbitrator's Guide, if all parties request or agree to such fees, the panel may award attorney's fees. In this case, he told the panel, both parties requested attorney's fees in this dispute. Therefore, this burden is met. And I'm quoting from an affidavit presented by Mr. Walker's counsel to the arbitrators at the conclusion of the arbitration. Walker argued to the arbitration panel that FINRA's Code of Arbitration Procedure 13212 provides the panel authority to assess attorney's fees as a sanction. That's also legally correct. There was no dispute at any time during the arbitration that the arbitrators had authority to award attorney's fees on any or all of these grounds. At the end of the arbitration, the arbitrators found against Mr. Walker. They required him to return the confidential customer information he had taken. They granted Mr. Miller and Ameriprise permanent injunctive relief. They awarded Mr. Miller actual damages of $76,000 after taking offsets for commissions that were owed to Mr. Walker, which were not in dispute. And they awarded Mr. Miller his reasonable attorney's fees in the amount of approximately $96,000. They specifically stated in their award that they were awarding attorney's fees under Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code Section 38001, which allows an award of reasonable attorney's fees on a breach of contract claim. They denied Mr. Walker's request for damages and attorney's fees, and they issued a final award. That award was issued on September 1st, 2015. So the claims against Mr. Walker, brought by Mr. Miller, were filed on June 5th, 2015, and they were fully, finally, and efficiently resolved through arbitration within 3 months, with the final award being issued on September 1st, 2015. That should have been the end of the story. As this court knows, an arbitration award is given the same effect as a judgment of last resort, and all reasonable inferences are indulged in favor of the award and none against it. Because of that, parties are not entitled to challenge in court the result of an arbitration award. They have only a limited right to challenge the fairness of the process. Here, there are absolutely no facts to suggest that the process was not fair or that the panel went beyond what the parties agreed to submit to arbitration. Under these circumstances, a party cannot go to court and try to reduce the damages awarded by an arbitration panel. As a recent Dallas Court of Appeals opinion recognized, the Centex Vestal versus Friendship W. Baptist Church opinion from 2010, the Dallas Court of Appeals put it quite succinctly. Arbitrators do not exceed their authority when the matter addressed is one which the parties agreed to arbitrate. In the context of arbitration, there is no second bite at the proverbial apple. A party cannot submit an issue to the arbitration panel and then, when an unfavorable result occurs, claim the arbitrators exceeded their authority in deciding the issue. If every party who lost in arbitration were allowed to take back their agreement to submit the issue to arbitration and relitigate the issue in court, arbitration would be meaningless. There is no question here that Mr. Walker agreed to submit the issue of attorney's fees to the arbitration panel. He only tried to take back that agreement when they awarded fees to Miller instead of to him. After the adverse award, Mr. Walker filed a motion in court here in Tarrant County seeking to vacate the attorney's fee portion of the award under the Federal Arbitration Act. Taking a position opposite to his position in arbitration, Mr. Walker argued that the arbitrators had no authority to award attorney's fees to Miller. Nearly 2 years later, in May of this year, May 26, 2017, the trial court entered judgment. The trial court granted Mr. Walker's motion to vacate the arbitrator's attorney's fee award and denied Mr. Miller's motion for sanctions for a frivolous motion to vacate. No written opinion accompanied the court's judgment. We believe that this court's de novo review of the record will demonstrate that the arbitrators did have authority to award Mr. Miller attorney's fees, and there's absolutely no basis for Mr. Walker's motion to vacate or for the trial court's vacature of the attorney's fee award. The first issue I believe this court needs to look at in deciding those issues is whether the party's dispute was arbitrated pursuant to the arbitration agreement in the 2009 AFA contract or pursuant to the uniform submission agreements of the parties, FINRA rules, and Texas law. And again, that's setting aside the issues of consent, waiver, and judicial estoppel, which we have also argued. But even if the issue of attorney's fees was not submitted by consent, even if judicial estoppel bars Mr. Walker's claim that attorney's fees could not be decided, and even if he did not waive that, which we believe all of those three things apply, we think that still there's nothing that prohibited this arbitration panel from awarding attorney's fees. And the way I think the court can most easily see that is even if the arbitration clause in the 2009 agreement didn't exist, this case would still have been arbitrated. So there's no basis for Mr. Walker's claim that that arbitration clause somehow controlled the authority of the arbitrators in this case. And Mr. Walker specifically recognized this when he signed the uniform submission agreement at the beginning of the arbitration. The agreement that Mr. Walker signed stated that the undersigned party hereby submits the present matter and controversy as set forth in the attached statement of claim, answers, and all related cross-claims, counterclaims, and/or third-party claims which may be asserted to arbitration in accordance with the FINRA bylaws, rules, and code of arbitration procedure. Mr. Walker knew at the time he signed the uniform submission agreement that Mr. Miller's pleadings sought attorney's fees. He did not challenge the arbitrability of that claim. He did not claim that the panel's authority was somehow limited by a separate written arbitration clause, and in fact, the arbitration clause in the 2009 agreement was never raised or discussed. All parties, including Mr. Walker, recognized throughout the arbitration proceeding that Texas law and the FINRA rules controlled. Then during the...
I have a question. Yes. Are they necessarily exclusive? I mean, is arbitration under FINRA necessarily exclusive of incorporating the arbitration agreement in the... Okay, so why can't the rules of FINRA apply and the arbitration agreement also apply?
Well, I don't believe that they are exclusive, but I would point out to the court that in this case, the arbitration clause that is being asserted specifically does exclude the type of claim that Mr. Miller was bringing. So, yes, while you could have an arbitration clause that also applied to a FINRA dispute, in this case, the arbitration clause specifically excluded any claims brought under Section 8 of the agreement, which was the section that Mr. Walker breached. So in the AFA agreement, Section 8 deals with confidentiality and non-solicitation of clients. That's the provision that Mr. Walker breached. Section 9 of the agreement is the provision that contains the arbitration clause. It says that this arbitration clause does not apply to claims brought brought under Section 8 for violation of the confidentiality and non-solicitation provisions. And the reason for that, Your Honor, is that FINRA has a very specific procedure in place for these types of claims. This is actually common in the financial services industry, where when one financial advisor leaves a broker-dealer and goes to another and improperly takes or uses customer information or improperly solicits clients, there is a specific procedure in place through FINRA. It's FINRA Rule 13804, and what it states is that that dispute will be arbitrated, but that if immediate relief is required, the claimant, in this case Mr. Miller and Ameriprise, may go to state court, get a TRO, but must contemporaneously file an arbitration proceeding with FINRA within 24 hours. FINRA then takes jurisdiction, holds a hearing on permanent injunctive relief within 15 days, and then if necessary sets a further hearing on damages. So that's what happens here. That's what happened here. And this agreement, this AFA agreement, Associate Financial Advisor Agreement, by which Mr. Walker joined Mr. Miller's practice, recognized that there was already a procedure in place for that type of dispute. So that arbitration clause specifically stated that it did not apply or modify FINRA rules with regard to the breach of confidentiality or customer non-solicitation provisions. So that's the situation that we have here. And during the arbitration, both parties did include a claim for attorney's fees in their pleadings. It was not just Mr. Miller that requested attorney's fees. Mr. Walker also requested attorney's fees. Both parties, as I've stated, told the panel that they had authority to award attorney's fees, and at the conclusion of the arbitration, both parties submitted affidavits in support of their claim for attorney's fees. And that was the only testimony that was actually taken by affidavit in the arbitration. The arbitrators ruled that all other testimony must be presented live, but pursuant to the stipulation of the parties, they agreed that each party may submit their attorney's fees claim by affidavit. So that was an agreement that the parties had. And both parties did that, and neither party made any sort of objection to the other party's attorney's fee affidavit or the other party's claim for attorney's fees. So the second question that I think the court needs to look at, if it reaches this point, is whether even if the AFA agreement did apply to this dispute, for example, as Justice Walker pointed out, they're not mutually exclusive and the arbitration agreement still does apply, does it prohibit an award of attorney's fees to Mr. Miller? Well, the answer to that question is no. For the first, because of the issue we already discussed, that the arbitration clause specifically states that it does not apply to a claim for breach of confidentiality or customer non-solicitation. Secondly, there's nothing in the arbitration clause in the 2009 AFA agreement that prohibits a statutory award of attorney's fees to any person or party. That arbitration clause is completely silent as to the rights of any party other than Mr. Walker or Ameriprise. And with regard to Mr. Walker and Ameriprise, it specifically states that they can get an award of attorney's fees as a statutory remedy by an arbitrator. So even if that arbitration clause did govern this dispute, that arbitration clause does not prohibit a statutory award of attorney's fees to any person. And Texas law, as I've stated, 38001 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code expressly allows attorney's fees when a party recovers damages for a breach of contract, which Mr. Miller
but
did.
But wouldn't the arbitration agreement, wouldn't the AFA trump the common law? I mean, if you agree to arbitrate and these are the provisions that only those Ameritrade and...
Absolutely, Your Honor. If there was a statement in the if the arbitration clause applied to this dispute, and if there was a statement in the arbitration clause that said, you know, Mr. Miller may not recover attorney's fees, Mr. Walker may not recover attorney's fees, Ameriprise may not recover attorney's fees, if that existed and if that applied to this dispute, then absolutely, that could modify the
but
party's
rights. But what's the
difference
between it stating in the affirmative and having an omission?
Well, it's simply silent. We first have the issue that it says it doesn't apply in a dispute right. that has to do with confidentiality or customer non-solicitation. But also, it's silent as to the issue of any party other than Mr. Walker or Mr. Ameriprise Ameriprise or Mr. Walker recovering attorney's fees. So it does not prohibit an award of attorney's fees to Mr. Miller, and it does not prohibit an award of attorney's fees to Ameriprise or Mr. Walker. So to suggest that there's something in that, I mean, what that agreement says is that parties will pay their own legal fees except to the extent that a statute allows them to recover their fees. That's what it says. And that's understandable because if Mr. Miller were to have taken this case to court instead of to arbitration, if he didn't have a statutory basis for attorney's fees, he would have had to pay his attorney's fees. But if he had taken this claim to court, he would have recovered attorney's fees because he had a breach of contract claim. And there's simply no writing signed by Mr. Miller or agreed to by the parties that says if you go to arbitration instead of court, you're giving up your statutory right to attorney's fees. That agreement doesn't exist.
Thank you.
Thank
your
you.
Your time has expired.
And I will yield the floor, and I've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Absolutely.
May it please the court. I'm Rick Disney. I'm here with my co-counsel, Brian Essenwine, representing the appellee, Jeremy Walker, in this case. We all understand that arbitration is generally favored in the law. But a party cannot be compelled to arbitrate in the absence of an agreement to arbitrate. If there's an express agreement to arbitrate, that agreement must be followed according to its terms. If the agreement contains a limitation on the arbitration, that limitation is binding on not only the parties, but more importantly, the arbitrators. In our case, there was a written arbitration agreement that limited the authority of the arbitration panel to award fees. We believe our case is very similar to the City of Arlington versus Kovacs case, in that our panel, like the arbitrator and Kovacs, ignored the limit on authority, and therefore the award had to be set aside. In Kovacs, the written arbitration agreement came from the city's personnel manual, and it said that an arbitrator can consider events that occurred up to the point of termination. In that case, I'm sure you recall, the arbitrator considered events after the termination date, which is clearly contrary to the limited authority the arbitrator got, and this court said so.
But that didn't involve FINRA.
No, it did not. And you're right.
And so my question is, how does the written arbitration agreement here juxtapose with the requirement that because both Mr. Walker and Mr. Miller are registered with FINRA, that they had to submit their dispute for arbitration through the FINRA rules?
I'm going to get into the specifics of AFA, and that's the real answer, is in the absence of a written arbitration agreement, FINRA people have to arbitrate. Absolutely. But the FINRA rules pretty well set out the mechanisms to do so. They don't provide the cause of action. And the law is clear. There's a case we found recently out of the Second Circuit in 2016, Credit Suisse Securities v. Tracy, 812 Fed 3rd 249, that specifically says the general rules in FINRA may be overridden or superseded by the more specific contractual provision. I'll be happy to provide a copy of that case to the opposing counsel and the clerks when I sit down. Ms. Blair made the good point, and she made it in her brief as well, that really points out the difference in approaches to this case. On page 5 of Miller's brief, he lays out the fundamental disagreement between the parties. Quote, "This dispute was not arbitrated under any written arbitration agreement governed by Texas or Minnesota law, but rather under FINRA bylaws, rules, and code of arbitration procedure because the parties are FINRA-associated persons," as you pointed out. Once it's understood that this is fundamentally not true, then the rest of the puzzle pieces will fall into place. In truth, Miller's claim in arbitration, by his own admission, was founded on the Associate Financial Advisor Agreement, the AFA, which is attached as tab A to our brief. Importantly, the AFA included a written and specific arbitration agreement. Now, as she said, a Miller Prize and Miller initially filed suit against Walker and district court got a TRO preventing Walker from soliciting Miller's clients. They asked for damages in the arbitration for what they called improper solicitation. Miller was awarded damages. Mr. Walker paid those damages. Ameriprise was not awarded any damages. When Mr. Miller submitted his dispute to arbitration.
Counsel, can you stop there just a moment? You're not, there's no question or dispute about the fact that Mr. Miller was the prevailing party in this arbitration matter, and consistent with the provisions in the section 38.001 et sic, which are the ones following, was entitled under Texas statutory law to recover attorney's fees.
But for the limitations in the AFA, you're exactly right.
Yeah, I understand.
That's where I have to hang. That's where I hang my hat.
I want to ask you one. A rhetorical question. How many apples do you get to take another bite?
Well, and if this is properly characterized as a second bite, that's not right.
Well,
on the other hand...
But let me ask you, if you had a second bite whenever you filed in Tarrant County District Court, and now you got another bite here in the Court of Appeals, how many times does a court or a person have a right to get a ruling on a agreed upon submission to a three panel arbitration board? I mean, why did your client or your people counseling him go to arbitration if you didn't want to follow the arbitration ruling?
The AFA required us to arbitrate.
So that's the answer to your argument that the AFA says, I mean, the rules of the security industry put you in the arbitration.
Without the AFA, we're in arbitration because of FINRA rules.
Yes, sir, that's what I'm saying.
But the AFA, FINRA rules can be limited and narrowed by written agreement, which is what the AFA does.
Wait, your written agreement consisted of your submission statement signed in front of that presented the issue to the arbitration panel.
The submission agreement is part of the FINRA rules. Anytime you arbitrate under the FINRA, as I understand it, either because you're both FINRA-associated persons or because there is a written arbitration agreement, this is a standard form, has to be signed. It does not expand the AFA, and that's my point is... A specific agreement has to control over the broad general rules.
And a specific agreement makes specific statement that a recovery of attorney's fees allowed by state law is still within the AFA agreement.
I respectfully disagree on that. It's important to understand that when we're interpreting the written arbitration agreement, the general rules of contract interpretation applies. And one of the important maxims on interpreting contracts is the specific controls over the general. There's also my favorite Latin phrase, if I can do it right, expressio unius, that's exclusio alterius. If the parties agree to set out a limited number of things in a provision, then it's presumed that they intended to exclude those that they didn't include. Crucially, the AFA says there's a very, very broad arbitration agreement that we're bound by. Walker signed it, said you have to bring anything has to be arbitrated. But then there's a separate section on attorney's fees. And it says, let me find my quote. What it's saying is, what it said was Ameriprise and Walker have to bear their own fees, except if it's statutorily justified. So in that sense, what Walker and Ameriprise did, again, remember, Miller's not a signator. Miller is identified as an independent advisor in the AFA. And the phrase independent advisor is mentioned 20-plus times. So when Ameriprise and Walker intended to include Miller in some of the provisions of the AFA, they knew how to do it. 20 different times they mentioned him. But what's crucial here, and it's a very narrow point I'm making, is the attorney's fees provision said Ameriprise or Walker may seek fees. Now,
let me ask you this.
Sir.
The AFA clearly is an executory contract to arbitrate a future dispute. And the FINRA rules clearly establish upon associates a obligation to arbitrate future disputes. The question I have is whether or not in signing the Uniform Submission Agreement, the parties can expand on the AFA at that point in time. What language was there in the Uniform Submission Agreements that specifically limited what is effectively a new arbitration agreement to the AFA limitations?
My concern is this is a standard Uniform Submission Agreement. It has to be signed by everybody. If that overrides...
But there are necessarily terms in that agreement, correct?
As I understand it.
And those terms would include what is subject to what the parties are agreeing to submit to arbitration, i.e., the AFA is establishing what that a dispute in the future, whatever that dispute may be, is subject to arbitration. The Uniform Submission Agreements are establishing what is, in fact, the dispute. If that agreement, which is a separate and distinct agreement, sets forth the dispute between Miller and Walker and includes the attorney's fees, why is that not a non-executory agreement to arbitrate at that point in time?
If the court concludes that the submission agreement overrides the AFA, that would be the result. However, what we're trying to do is look at the party's intention. When the AFA was signed, they set the parameters. And I think it would be a mistake to suggest a form contract that everybody has to sign that's non-negotiable, not revised in any way, just has general broad language, the same way the FINRA rules do. What we need to look at is the AFA.
Well, it seems like that this should be an issue that's been settled. It seems like that there should be arbitration agreement that then is subject to FINRA, and there has to be, even if it's not in the context of attorney's fees, but the context of limitation of issues to be arbitrated. It seems like whether the AFA or FINRA controls whether attorney's fees can be awarded should be a settled issue.
Well, and I we believe this is the thing that's settled. The Second Circuit Federal Court says FINRA is an independent organization. It's a self-regulatory organization, and use of the FINRA arbitration forum to adjudicate disputes is governed by the code, and it sets out the general stuff on what's done. But it says, we have held in several cases that a securities-related organization's arbitrations provisions are default rules, which may be overridden by more specific contractual terms. That's where we have to go.
Counsel, you didn't raise that in arbitration, did you?
You know, arbitration, waiving things in arbitration is not the same kind of waiver you get in a trial court.
I didn't say anything about a waiver. I said to you, and I asked you, and I meant that to be in a question
form. I'm sorry.
You did not raise the provision about limitation on attorney's fees in the arbitration.
Okay, what we did was we said he didn't have any standing. He has no right to bring any claim. And we lost that. There was no point in arguing, well, he can't use attorney's fees. We said he can't bring a damage claim. He has no standing. The court said that he's a third-party beneficiary under the contract. which is the only basis for this non-solicitation claim he brought, the breach of contract. They ruled against us on that. We didn't appeal it. But there's no point in haggling over attorney's fees when our position was he didn't have any standing at all. But once they said he's a third-party beneficiary, that means that he steps into the AFA and is governed by all the provisions, including the limitations.
Well, how do you get around the last phrase of the AFA agreement that provides a specific exception to the language that came before it?
You're talking.
They shall each be responsible for their own cost of legal representation, if any, except where such cost of legal representation may be awarded as a statutory remedy by the arbitrator.
And that language is limited, specifically says Walker and Ameriprise. It does not say Miller. That's the whole point we're making, is by specifically saying Walker and Ameriprise either pay their own attorney's fees or they can ask for it if it's a statutory remedy. They did not include Miller in that section.
Then how does the logic juxtapose to get to the point where Mr. Walker was entitled to attempt to recover attorney's fees from Miller in the arbitration?
I'm not sure I understand.
Well, you asked for attorney's fees in
the arbitration. We asked for attorney's fees.
Against Miller?
Yes.
But what you just said is Miller's not a part of this, so.
Well, we asked for it. We didn't get it. I mean, is that a waiver? We were invoking our right under the statute, or under the AFA. The AFA doesn't say Walker can only get it from Ameriprise. Okay, what it says is who has the standing to raise a claim for attorney's fees? And the answer is Walker and Ameriprise.
Well, when you get through with the process of the presentation of the issues to the arbitration panel without raising this point you're making in your brief and in your argument you made to the trial court, I'm at a loss to understand why judicial estoppel is not a matter that you should have addressed head on and hard in your briefing and in your argument today, and you not mention that.
Would you like me to respond, or should I?
Yes, sir, I certainly would. I don't know if the light came on, but
I did.
It was my long question that caused it to come on.
Again, we asserted rights given to us in the AFA. Okay, we said Miller doesn't have any standing at all and no right to bring damages. So the fact that we didn't specifically address his right to recover attorney's fees, clearly if he's not entitled to recover damages, he's not entitled to recover attorney's fees. So that's, I mean, you have to make tactical decisions during any trial, including arbitration. And we thought the better case was to argue that he did not have standing, could not raise the cause of action. When the panel disagreed, okay, fine, that's the way it is, and we didn't appeal that.
They disagreed, and they made an award that was a final award by arbitration.
Of damages, which we paid.
And of attorney's fees, which you're contesting.
Which we're contesting. Under
now, how do you address, last question I'll ask you, how do you address the language in paragraph 8 under section 10, I mean under section 9, it says, any award by an arbitration panel shall be final and binding upon the parties. Judgment made all of the rest of that.
Well,
I mean, it's saying that if you're going to go through arbitration and you do all the arbitration and you raise the points in arbitration and you say we raise the overall point that Miller just doesn't get any benefits, but they said, no, that's not right. Well, that's a ruling of the panel. And then the final award of damages and attorney's fees pursuant to 38.001 is also a final award by an arbitration panel.
Unless they exceeded their authority. And that's the hole that we've got to go through. I view it as a little bit like a lower court doing something, and on appeal they're saying, you didn't have jurisdiction to do it. That's not getting a second bite at it. That's saying you exceeded your authority in making that a ruling.
But you raised that opinion, you raised that issue, and it was rejected by finding of the arbitration panel.
Well, the issue of whether they had exceeded their authority, I believe, is like a jurisdictional question, should always be able to be raised. Because, yeah, the fact that they ruled it let's say a court without jurisdiction rules. Is that a final, unappealable judgment? No. You always have a right to look at whether it was in the power of the trial court to do that.
Counsel, you did not have a choice about submitting this matter to arbitration according to the rules, the statutory guidelines and the rules of the people in the securities industry, and your two people are both in the securities industry.
That is true. But
so when you say I had no choice but to arbitrate, but I can limit what the arbitration people can do, and I'm going to ignore certain of the rules in the arbitration.
I respectfully disagree.
Provisions.
What we said was we already agreed to the narrow provisions governing attorney's fees. So arbitration panel, you need to follow the agreement. We have a written arbitration agreement, the AFA. And as we briefed, I hope, well, to say that if there is an express agreement, you have to follow the agreement according to its terms.
And I got that point. And I thank you for your presentation, counsel.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Disney. Ms. Blair, rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. A few points. I agree, as we discussed a little earlier, I do agree that if Mr. Miller had entered into an agreement, a written agreement, where he agreed to limit his rights, that would be enforceable. And the fact is here that Mr. Miller never entered into an agreement under which he gave up his right to recover attorney's fees under 38001 if Mr. Walker breached a contract. And the FINRA rules don't require that. And to suggest, for Mr. Disney to suggest that Mr. Walker and his counsel's arguments throughout the arbitration that Mr. Miller was not recovered to any damages was a challenge to his right to recover attorney's fees under an arbitration agreement flies in the face of the way he started his presentation, which is that the specific controls over the general. If you come in and you say, I don't think I breached a contract, I don't think I did anything wrong, I don't think Mr. Miller should get any damages, then you tell the arbitration panel, and by the way, you have authority to award attorney's fees under 38001, under FINRA rules, as a sanction, all different kinds of ways that you have authority to award attorney's fees. Well, I would think that those specific arguments that you make to the panel certainly override your general denial that Mr. Miller has a right to any recovery at all.
But the contract that the arbitrators found was breached was the AFA, correct?
Yes.
And the AFA has a specific limitation on attorney's fees.
It limits attorney's fees
recoverable
to where there is a
arbitration.
Statutory basis for attorney's fees. And the statute under which the arbitrators awarded attorney's fees here was 38001.
Here's the problem is that Miller is saying he's entitled to recover for breach of the AFA, but he's not bound by the limitation as to attorney's fees under the AFA as being recoverable only by Ameriprise and Walker.
The attorney's fee agreement, respectfully, Your Honor, does not say that attorney's fees are only recoverable by Ameriprise and Mr. Walker. The AFA agreement limits the rights of two parties to recover attorney's fees. It says they will bear the cost of their own legal representation, Ameriprise and Mr. Walker. It then sets out an exception to that limitation. It does not put any limits on Mr. Miller or any other party's right to recover attorney's fees. I would also point out that this was not a reasoned award from the arbitrator. We don't know what the contract was that the arbitrators found Mr. Walker breached. There were a number of oral agreements. There were a number of agreements between them that were discussed in the during the course of the arbitration. There were a number of breaches by Mr. Walker. Was it the breach of the 2009 AFA agreement specifically that they were resting their opinion on? That's not made clear. What is clear is that we can't go back and try and read the arbitrators' minds, figure out exactly why they awarded attorney's fees. We can only look at what they wrote, which is that they awarded attorney's fees under 38001, which allows attorney's fees for the breach of an oral or a written contract. Also, this has been specifically addressed, and this is cited in our briefing. The Hollerin case out of the 10th Circuit is one example where they specifically looked at whether the uniform submission agreements control over a prior written arbitration agreement and found that in the context of FINRA, it is the uniform submission agreements that control. And frankly, I think that that's consistent with the principle that arbitration is a matter of contract, and the AFA requires courts to honor the parties' expectations.
So they're required to enter into a uniform submission agreement as part of the FINRA rules, and the Tenth Circuit is saying that that constitutes effectively a new non-executory agreement to arbitrate at that point in time concerning the terms of that agreement.
Is that what
the Tenth Circuit held?
That is what the Tenth Circuit said in the Hollerin case. We have other cases cited in our briefing for that proposition. And if they do believe that something that's raised by the pleadings is not arbitrable, then that can be raised. But it was not raised here. The parties did agree to submit the matters raised by their pleadings to arbitration, and then Mr. Walker proceeded to include a claim for attorney's fees in his own pleadings. He also knew that there was a claim for attorney's fees in Mr. Miller's pleadings. And I would just point out, I have very little time left, that we're also asking this court to find that the trial court abused its discretion in not awarding Mr. Miller his attorney's fees for Mr. Walker's frivolous motion to vacate under Rule 13 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, which says that courts shall impose sanctions against an attorney or party who signs a pleading, motion, or other paper that is groundless or brought in bad faith or for purposes of harassment. We are now 2 years after we got the arbitration award, more than 2 years. Mr. Miller is still having to spend money on attorneys. He has had to use all of the money he was awarded in arbitration to fight this frivolous motion to vacate, and we feel that it frustrates the purposes of the FAA if he doesn't recover those fees. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Blair. Thank you, Mr. Disney. We appreciate your arguments and your presentations here today. Your case is submitted. The court will remain on the bench while you all depart and the next case moves forward.